Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much. Candace and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Advanced Skin Cancer. And today is part two of a two-part series, and today's title is Emerging Treatments for Metastatic Melanoma. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, including a number of melanoma organizations. And it's because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. So we have on the call today over 689 participants, and you come from all of the United States. And we have international participants from Canada, Lebanon, Pakistan, the Philippines, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it really is a credit to you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us on this program. Now, today's program has been made possible, supported by Bristol Myers Squibb, a grant from Genentech, an independent educational grant from Merck and Company, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program today and also for their collaborative partnership in making this program possible in terms of supporting it. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Hussein Tabi, and Dr. Tabi is Associate Professor, Director of Personalized Cancer Therapy Research, Melanoma Medical Oncology, Investigational Cancer Therapeutics, UT MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Tabi is going to address an overview of metastatic melanoma, including staging and diagnosing, current standard of care, and the role of personalized cancer therapy, asking questions about your treatment plan. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Tabi.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, for the kind introduction and for allowing me to participate in this excellent teleconference. Allow me also to welcome all of the participants and my colleagues for this session. We will be dedicating our discussion to the treatment of metastatic melanoma, and what I will do is I will briefly review the diagnosis and staging of melanoma and its progression from the skin to metastatic disease. This will provide the framework for the treatment options that you will hear more extensively about later. As you know, the vast majority of melanomas arise on the skin. They are typically brought to the attention of a dermatologist or to a primary care physician. The next step is usually a biopsy of a suspicious spot, and it is highly recommended that that be performed as a punch biopsy that gives us the full thickness of the tumor. The thickness of the tumor is, in fact, the most important determinant of metastatic potential, and that's why it's so important to get it at the first biopsy. Even a thin melanoma that is less than 1 millimeter has still has some potential for metastatic disease, although that potential is less than 10%. Now, an ulcerated melanoma that's as thick as only 4 millimeter has already over 40 to 50% chance of metastasis. The second most important determinant is whether the regional lymph nodes are involved. And that is usually determined at the time of surgery with a procedure called a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And again, the detection of even microscopic cells in the lymph nodes is indicative of a higher risk of metastatic disease. Now, once melanoma metastasizes beyond the local regional area, it is called metastatic melanoma. And it involves other lymph nodes, but it also can involve the lung, liver, and even the brain. Before we delve into the treatment specifics, I think it will be very important that you understand that not all metastatic disease is the same. It is all called stage 4, but what we really understand from metastatic disease is the fact that the tumor has essentially gained access to the bloodstream and is traveling through the blood to the to these distant organs. However, in melanoma, there is a subclassification of stage 4 disease where we call it M1A, M1B, or M1C disease. And that is simply because if the tumor is only deposited in the skin, subcutaneous tissue, or lymph nodes, we call that M1A. If it's deposited in the lungs, we call that M1B. If it involves other visceral organs or the brain, then we call it M1C. And it's very important that we realize that the two most important parameters in determining the severity of metastatic disease is, number one, whether the brain is involved or not, and that happens in up to 40% of patients at presentation. That is the reason part of the metastatic workup is an MRI of the brain that is very important to test early, and in the presence of metastatic disease should probably be done every few months to determine whether the brain is involved. The other important determinant is LDH levels. LDH, or lactate dehydrogenase, is actually a blood test, but it has been associated with outcome in melanoma. Even in the absence of any therapy, having a lower LDH is associated with a better survival. Now, while melanoma remains a challenging disease to treat, the treatment options have seen a period of true amazing growth and progress in the last 5 to 10 years. When I started treating melanoma patients only around 10 years ago, our options were extremely limited. And in the 3 decades that preceded that, we only had 2 FDA-approved drugs that were really approved on the basis of marginal benefit. We are really fortunate at this time that all of our patients stand a much better chance at beating this disease because of the progress that has happened in the last 5 to 10 years. In fact, we went from 2 treatments that were approved over 30 years, and now we have over 10 different treatments and combinations that have been approved in the last 5 years alone for metastatic melanoma. So this is a time of huge excitement and tremendous progress that's already manifesting in improved outcomes for our patients with melanoma. This is true in terms of overall survival, but also in terms of symptom control, and frankly, just the sense that we are gaining so much ground against this disease. This progress has been and is being achieved through research, basic clinical and translational research, that allowed us a better understanding of the molecular mechanisms driving the tumor cells itself, but also the interaction of the tumor cell with its environment and with the immune system. You will be hearing today about various therapeutic options, and they are generally divided into 2 broad categories, immunotherapy and targeted therapy. Again, the field of melanoma has really been fortunate to be at the forefront of progress of both approaches. Targeted therapy is usually that with the use of pills that are called small molecule inhibitors that target the inner workings of the cancer cell. Those are drugs that usually end with the letters ENIB or INIBs, which really implies that they're inhibitors of a certain proteins called kinases. And our understanding of the mutations that have actually that drive melanoma have led to the development of these specific drugs that can be exceptionally effective in the treatment of BRAF mutated melanoma. So BRAF, BRAF is a mutation that occurs in half of all melanomas, and combination therapy that involves dabrafenib trametinib or vemurafenib cobimetinib, those are you're going to hear about more extensively a little later, have been very effective at shrinking down the disease in 80 to 90% of patients. Although sometimes that shrinkage may not be long-lasting, on the other hand, immunotherapy, which remains in the form of intravenous infusions, and the drug names are usually ending with the letters MAB or MAB, you will be hearing about ipilimumab, pembrolizumab, and nivolumab, those drugs have made tremendous impact in terms of single agent and even combination therapies. And you will hear us talk about them also as checkpoint inhibitors later through the call. These have truly made breakthroughs and revolutionized the field of cancer therapy altogether. And those drugs have truly emboldened us to speak of cure in the metastatic setting. And what was once a pipe dream is now a really common occurrence in our clinics. I will end with an overview of personalized therapy, and we'll discuss this again a little further down the line, but what I really want to discuss with you today is that when people think of personalized therapy, there is this vision that your oncologist will be using some sci-fi technology to decide whether to treat you or not. But in reality, all of those clinical parameters we just discussed, you know, presence or absence of brain metastases, the levels of LDH in the blood, where is the occurrence of the metastatic disease in your body, all of those will actually affect the treatment decisions. They're important, excuse me, There are also important factors such as your performance status. How is the disease affecting your daily life? And those are very important factors that will help us not only understand or predict how efficacious our therapy is going to be, but also potentially the likelihood of toxicity. So as you hear about the impact of newer therapies later in the session, I'm confident that you will be amazed, as we all are, at how much we can do for metastatic melanoma patients nowadays and how much benefit we can provide them. But you should also know that there are many unanswered questions. We still don't know exactly how to sequence our therapies, which ones to start with, whether to use treatments alone or in combination. We still also do not serve about 40% of our patients, and we don't have a full understanding of how those novel therapies work in the brain. And we really have a significant challenge in figuring out even better therapies, because we want to be to have treatments that are even more effective than what we have and hopefully less toxic. None of this knowledge and progress can be acquired without research, so participating in clinical trial is an essential component for us to understand all of those unanswered questions that can truly be answered only in the setting of prospective clinical trials that are efficiently and quickly conducted. And with that, I will conclude my remarks and give it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Tadi. That was really outstanding and just so informative and comprehensive. Just a kind of a whirlwind of information for everybody, and I think this will be very helpful, and particularly also will spur some questions during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Jason Luke. Dr. Luke is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Melanoma and Developmental Therapeutics Clinic, University of Chicago Medicine. And Dr. Luke is going to address new treatment approaches, the role of immuno-oncology, which I know you're hearing a lot about in the news, and targeted therapy, the role of personalized medicine. And it's now my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Luke.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, and thank you very much to Dr. Twaby for that introduction, which I really do think was excellent in setting up the rest of our conversation today. It was just mentioned which topics I'm going to cover, and I'm actually just going to move them into a slightly different order and go over the targeted therapies and then immuno-oncology and then new treatments, where I think we start to see the intersection between other therapeutic modalities. But to follow on what was discussed before, when we think about targeted therapy and personalized medicine in quotes in melanoma, for the most part, people are talking about DNA-based testing of the tumor to look for what kind of mutations are different in the cancer as compared to the rest of the body that might facilitate the ability to give a drug that would go especially after the tumor and not cause side effects in the rest of the body. And the case study for this is, as was mentioned, the gene BRAF, B-R-A-F, which gets messed up or mutated in about a half of patients who have metastatic melanoma. And that's really important because there's been a groundbreaking effort developing new drugs and now combinations of drugs to maximize the effect of going just after that messed up gene in the melanoma relative to the rest of the body. And you heard about a couple of different drug combinations already. They have names like dabrafenib and trametinib, or vemurafenib and cobimetinib. There's even a third one now called encorafenib and binimetinib. And so all of these work very similarly. They're oral medicines that you take on a daily basis. And as was mentioned, they commonly can shrink the tumors pretty fast, within days, that people can start feeling better. They are a little bit sort of like antibiotics, however, that if you continue to take them over a long period of time, in many patients, the efficacy starts to wane and the benefit starts to eventually go away. But we know that there's a fraction of patients who can do very, very well for a very long time. The most recent updates suggested that perhaps a third of patients who start on those drugs are on them doing very well at year three. And so a future question will be how to maximize that benefit kind of moving forward. I'll also make a note that there's been a recent clinical trial data suggesting that those patients who have mutations in a gene called NRAS, N-R-A-S, may also benefit from using targeted therapies with a molecule called a MEK inhibitor, where outcomes were improved relative to chemotherapy by doing that. And you may see that in the next year, the FDA may approve the drug called binimetinib, for treatment of patients with NRAS melanoma. So that's something that's coming. And then finally, we also know that there's a smaller fraction of patients who have mutations in a gene called KIT, K-I-T. And in that situation, there are drugs that have been around for a while for other kinds of cancers, a drug known as imatinib, that also appears to have a substantial benefit for some of those patients. So understanding which mutations are present in the tumor is important because it can help to guide which treatments can actually be chosen. From there, though, I'm going to shift to discussion regarding immuno-oncology agents. And it's worth noting that melanoma has really been at the forefront of immuno-oncology really for decades because it's been noted that a very small number of patients can seem to have an immune response that can get rid of the cancer. And that was known in the context of a treatment with a drug called interleukin-2 or IL-2. And that was a pretty tough treatment where patients had to be put in the hospital to get it, but perhaps 10% or more of patients can have a long-term survival after getting that drug. So that wasn't great because it was only 10%, but it set the stage for future immune system treatments. And that category of treatments now has been described as immune checkpoint blocking agents. And they're immune checkpoints because we've learned that sort of like in your car with the gas and the brake pedal or perhaps like an airplane, the switches that are switched to take off and then some are switched to go down, the immune system is regulated in a somewhat similar fashion. And the first of those drugs to gain regulatory approval and to become a standard of care was the drug ipilimumab, which blocks a molecule called CTLA-4. And don't worry, there's no test at the end of this. I don't remember all these science names, but sometimes it's helpful. Ipilimumab blocks the natural off mechanism of the immune system, which allows the immune cells then to be more on and perhaps go and kill the cancer more. And with that, we're now learning that perhaps a quarter of patients treated with ipilimumab seem to have long-term durable survival. Unfortunately, there is an association with a relatively small but significant incidence of high-grade side effects that can sometimes hospitalize patients. And it has to be considered and watched closely by the doctor who's giving the drug. The next category of immune system drugs or immune checkpoint blocking agents are anti-programmed death or PD-1 antibodies, which are now revolutionizing melanoma, but are revolutionizing all of cancer therapy and other cancers like lung cancer and kidney cancer and bladder and many others. Because with those treatments, we found that that's really an essential immune checkpoint in the regulation of the immune response in cancer. And really what it is that some immune cells in your body may be able to get to the cancer, but then they get shut off by the cancer using this PD-1 or PD-L1 mechanism. By giving this drug, you can wake up those natural immune cells that already know the cancer's there, which can then kill the cancer. And that's really been a powerful treatment with almost 40% or more of patients doing very well over long periods of time. And the drugs are so new that we don't really know how well that will work over the long haul. Those drugs are associated with much less side effects than ipilimumab. I guess I should note that the PD-1 antibodies have names like nivolumab and pembrolizumab. You may have heard Jimmy Carter got pembrolizumab. But again, those drugs are highly effective and seem to not cause so much in the way of side effects. Most recently, we've been looking at combining these immune system treatments with ipilimumab and nivolumab. And that treatment is even more powerful in shrinking the tumors and maybe even better at lengthening out how long patients do over the long haul, although the clinical trials where that was done are relatively young, and we don't have long-term outcome data as yet. Unfortunately, the side effect profile of combining the two immune system treatments really does amplify things quite dramatically, such that more than half of patients now get significant side effects. So there is a debate in the field about what the best thing to do right now is in terms of giving the anti-PD-1 antibody alone first or giving the combination. And I think it really goes to a decision about what's our risk-benefit association for an individual patient. How much side effects can we risk relative to how much benefit do we want to gain? And I think even on this call, probably not all the doctors necessarily agree, but they would agree that that conversation is something that each individual patient should have with their doctor. The final new treatment to a note is a virus therapy that was approved, something called Tolamygine Laharparepvec, or T-VEC, and that was an oncolytic herpes virus, just like you would get a cold sore in your mouth, but where the virus was changed to have immune gene from human beings so that when physicians literally take a needle and inject the virus into the tumors, it can basically burst the tumors and then release immune particles that recruit an immune response. Now, that therapy is really only approved for those patients who have disease, metastatic cancer that's on their skin or in lymph nodes where we can inject it, but it's really a new sort of approach in the treatment of cancer that hopefully we can use in the future as we think about combinations and finding the optimal personalized approach for each patient. In the last few moments, I'm going to talk about new approaches, and I'll just note that there are other targeted approaches that are possibilities. I talked about BRAF, NRAS, and KIT. There's also a gene called NF1 that's been found to be very important, where clinical trials are ongoing looking at drugs for that. And finally, there are just many, many, many other immune checkpoints that are under investigation. And so one that we're very interested in is a molecule called IDO, or indole dioxygenase, where when we combine that with the pembrolizumab PD-1 drug, we've seen really good results in an early trial. But I would just second, as Dr. Twabi mentioned, that we only can make progress in this field if we continue to do clinical trials to evaluate new drugs, because our hope is to get the most benefit for every individual patient and at the same time minimizing the side effects potentially could be associated with that treatment. So with that, I'm going to pass it back to the moderator and say thanks for your time, and I'll look forward to taking any of your questions later on.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Luke. That was really excellent. And also you delved further into some of the nuances and the new approaches to treatment and immunotherapy, and so very interesting. Thank you, and very helpful to our participants, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Pasto, and Dr. Pasto is Assistant Attending Physician, Melanoma and Immunotherapeutic Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Pasto is going to address the clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, and managing treatment side effects, discomfort, and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Pasto.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mesner, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with everyone on such an important topic related to melanoma and other skin cancer care. So we'll be taking a few minutes now to go through a couple of issues. The first part of my talk will be focused on clinical trials and how we find out new research advances that have led to all of the different drugs and treatment advances that we've been hearing about in our prior two speakers. And then toward the end of my talk, I'll be talking about how do we think about the side effects that can arise not only in clinical trials, but also with standard cancer agents to really make sure that we can take care of the side effects that we might be experiencing with our patients to really have the best possible outcomes before side effects become too problematic. So first, to start, I would like to talk a little bit about clinical trials. And clinical trials, in a way that they can be defined by many different ways. One way that they are defined is any investigational use of a drug or combination of particular drugs that's not approved by a regulatory body for use in patients. And although these are intended to be done for research purposes to understand about how new drugs might be working and how they could be interacting with existing drugs, our goal for all clinical trials, if a doctor is talking to you about participating in a particular clinical trial, really the idea is not just for the research, but it's also to try to offer a therapeutic benefit for a particular situation with cancer. And so there are many different types of clinical trials. And again, these are not necessarily all trials that are what are called randomized. So randomization is something that's used in some clinical trials, and that's where your doctor, or most often not even within your doctor's control, but the study design flips a coin. Basically, a computer will flip a coin and assign patients to one treatment or assign them to another treatment. Not all clinical trials are randomized in that type of a way. So many times patients and or their doctors will get a choice about what type of drugs are given within a particular clinical trial. However, it is important to keep in mind whether or not the trial that you may be considering to participate in is what's called randomized, meaning a computer often puts an assignment on a particular patient and treatment team about what type of pathway a particular patient will pursue. The other notion that's important to think about when we approach clinical trials in general concept is that not all clinical trials, in fact, most do not, include what's called a placebo treatment. Many of the fears patients have going into clinical trials, testing new drugs or new agents, is whether or not they'll actually be getting an active drug. There is some concern that maybe we'll just be getting a placebo, which is what's called a sugar pill. And I would like to add that clinical trials, for the most part, for patients with advanced skin cancers, particularly advanced melanoma, for the most part, they do not include that type of a placebo arm in the clinical trial. So it's very important to be very clear in that the majority of clinical trials do not include a randomization or assignment of a treatment arm, and they do not include a placebo, which is an inactive compound. So these are done with the intention to, number one, offer patients a very good, new, innovative treatment approach to treating melanoma, and secondly, also to advance the field of general knowledge for all melanoma patients, not just those in the clinical trials, but really for moving the field forward and advancing the treatment of melanoma. I'd like to take a couple of moments now to describe several phases of clinical trials. Typically, clinical trials can be broken down into several phases, such as phase one clinical trials, phase two clinical trials, phase three clinical trials, and then typically after phase three clinical trials, the drug may be ultimately approved by a regulatory agency within the government of different companies, countries, such as the United States Food and Drug Administration. And then after a clinical trial is complete, a phase three study, and a drug is approved by the FDA, for example, sometimes the drug continues to be studied in observational type clinical trials after approval, and that might be something that's sometimes considered a phase four trial. But for purposes of our broad picture understanding, I think considering clinical trials as a phase one, a phase two, or a phase three clinical trial is kind of a good general framework to think about potential clinical trials. Phase one clinical trials are typically the first clinical trials that patients can participate in. And not all phase one trials are the first time a particular drug is being given to patients. Some clinical trials in the phase one setting are the first time new drugs that are being developed are tested in patients for the first time. But many times, phase one clinical trials may be testing an existing drug already known to patients or already even FDA approved in combination with another drug that might not be FDA approved. So really, phase one trials are the first time something new is being done, either new combinations of drugs or new drugs are being tested for the first time in patients. And the goal of phase one trials really is to try to understand how the drug works in a particular patient, to see what it does in terms of its mechanism of action, in terms of fighting the cancer, and also to see how patients' bodies can metabolize the drug and ultimately get rid of the drug compound over time. In addition, we always are looking for efficacy in phase one trials. It may not be the first purpose of trying to do a phase one trial because once we're giving them to patients in new combinations or for the first time certain drugs are tested, sometimes we have to first just make sure it's a safe type of approach to give and that the side effects of a drug are not too great. However, we absolutely are always trying to see how effective it can be in a particular situation. And many patients participated in very large phase one trials of some of the anti-PD-1 drugs, such as nivolumab and pembrolizumab, and those very, very large phase one trials really did teach us a lot about how effective participation in those types of trials can be. Typically, phase one trials are smaller, usually less than 50 patients, and different doses or different combinations of doses are tested of investigational drugs to see what might be the best for further development. After phase one trials are complete, phase two trials typically begin, and the real goal of a phase two trial is to take the dose or the dose combination that was determined from phase one trials to be the most anticipated successful dose combination to really test in a larger group of patients how effective a particular treatment regimen is. And so typically phase two trials will include at least 50 patients, usually sometimes even into a couple of hundred numbers of patients. After phase two demonstrates really convincing efficacy of a particular approach, phase three trials may be conducted. Now, typically, phase three trials are what are called randomized, which is what we were talking about in the beginning of this section, which is that some patients may get one treatment and some patients may get another treatment. But again, even in phase three trials where patients may be assigned a particular treatment arm, typically that does not include what's called a placebo, which is the inactive sugar pill, essentially. And it's important to discuss with your doctor what type of a trial that you may be considering, what are the goals of that particular trial, is it a randomized type of a trial, is there a placebo? Those are all really important good questions to be asking. So as you're considering clinical trial participation, it's important to go through a process called informed consent, which is where your doctor or treatment team will give you a document of all of the risks, the benefits of trial participation, and the alternatives to trial participation to really work with you one-on-one and with your family members to try to understand if a clinical trial is the right approach for you. It is definitely not right for everyone, but it is very important to consider this with your treatment team, because clinical trials do contribute to additional treatment options, and there absolutely are incredible benefits that patients can attain for participating in clinical trials. So I'd like to spend a minute or two talking about what those benefits to the individual patient are. So number one, individual patients, by participating in clinical trials, may gain access to new promising treatments before they're technically FDA approved and otherwise able for broader access. And we had treated a number of patients in clinical trials to get access to all of these promising treatments that we've been hearing about, the BRAF and MEK inhibitors and the new immune therapy drugs, years before they were available in the countries and by the FDA. And therefore, those patients, by participating in the trials, had access to earlier treatment than they otherwise would have had access to. And so if it is appropriate in your treatment course, I really would encourage everyone to talk with their doctor to try to understand if there's a very exciting, new, promising drug in a clinical trial that may not be available otherwise, that may be a reason to consider participating in a clinical trial. And the other somewhat of a misperception of clinical trials is some people think, well, maybe I only need to do a clinical trial when other standard approaches don't work. And I think we need to remove ourselves from that mindset a bit, because clinical trials really can often be the first best treatment to try for patients with advanced melanoma, in that there are clinical trials where the standard of care agents are being tested in combination with new and promising agents, and that really may be the best way to even start treating advanced melanoma as the first type of a treatment. And again, weighing the risks and benefits and alternatives is really important in terms of considering whether that's appropriate for you. I would like now to transition from our discussion about clinical trials and advancing research into a discussion about how do we think about our management of side effects of clinical trial investigational drugs or even standard agents. And it's so critical that quality of life is maintained during cancer treatment, because it's important that we think about the entire patient and entire family. This is not just about treating the melanoma. This is about treating an entire patient and an entire patient support system, including family. And so what I would encourage everyone to do is to be very open and honest about any side effects that they may be experiencing if they're in a clinical trial or even if they're getting regular standard treatment, because doctors and nurses and other support staff can only help patients if we understand what it is that people are dealing with. And so with our patients, we're very, very aggressive about treating any pain that may be arising. And sometimes it's hard to talk about pain, and sometimes it can create some anxiety to be feeling that we have to be honest about all the different discomforts that we might be having, but it's very important to be forthcoming about that so that we can manage it aggressively with different types of pain medications. In addition to pain, there are other symptoms that can be very important while undergoing treatment for cancer, including nausea, constipation, vomiting, and even psychological distress, which is a reasonable way to feel anxious about where the cancer situation is, what are the treatment options, what does this mean for my family members. And so I would encourage all patients and family members to talk openly about their anxieties, to talk openly about the pain they may be experiencing, and talk openly about the different side effects that might be they may be experiencing, just so that these types of issues can be addressed in the most appropriate way. And often a palliative care expert who focuses directly on symptom management can be very, very helpful in addressing all these symptoms in a very comprehensive way. And so with that, I would like to thank you for discussing clinical trials, how we advance research in this area, the different phases of clinical trials, and I would encourage everyone to participate in clinical trials if they can, because not only for the possible benefits that it can provide to them, but also for how we move forward with new treatment options for patients, and to be forthcoming with the treatment team in management of side effects.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Pasta. That was really excellent. And again, very informative and very well communicated in terms of all the different things to think about and the details about clinical trials and their importance. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Tara Gangdar. And Dr. Gangdar is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Abrams Cancer Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Gangdar is going to address follow-up care, the tips for caring for your skin during cancer treatments, and discussing quality of life concerns with your healthcare team. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gangdar.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me, and I'm looking forward to the discussion. Regarding your follow-up care, it's important to know that you should see your care team regularly while you're on treatment for melanoma, which means either your doctor, your NP, or your PA should see you to discuss how you're feeling and so that you can talk about any new side effects or symptoms that you're having that could be related either to the melanoma or to the melanoma treatment, including some of the symptoms that Dr. Pastow talked about earlier, or any new symptoms that you've noticed. During your visit, you'll also likely have at times blood work to check your liver or kidney or endocrine function while you're on treatment, and that may be part of your visit as well. If you've started any new prescription medicines from other doctors, or if you've started on your own any new over-the-counter or complementary medicines, you should let your doctor know. And you should always have time during your follow-up visits to review all of your medications, ask questions about them, and your doctor may make adjustments or give you refill prescriptions if you need them. You should also have time to ask questions that are on your mind about your treatment. For some patients and family members, writing down a list of questions before your visit can really help ensure that all your questions are answered during the visit. And then when you leave the visit, you should have a very clear understanding of your treatment plan, when your next visit will be, and if there are any tests or imaging studies that your doctor wants you to have before your next visit. Most importantly, you should always know how to get in touch with your care team and contact them at all times, which includes during your doctor's office, but also during nights and weekends if you have an urgent question or an urgent new symptom. So you should know how to get a hold of them at any time. And while the follow-up visits are a face-to-face visit with your doctor, when you're being treated for melanoma, you should really feel comfortable and confident that you can always reach your care team at any time between visits, or that you can be seen more urgently in the office between visits if needed. You should not have to wait until your next visit if you have a new symptom or problem or any concern or question. And then, you know, finally, if many of you are comfortable with using email or online resources, then you should ask your care team if they have an email address or if there's an online hospital messaging system that you can use for non-urgent questions between visits as well. That can be a very helpful way to stay in touch with your care team. I'll just say a few words regarding caring for your skin, because I think we've heard about some of the side effects already from Dr. Pastow, but ultimately there are a lot of side effects that can involve your skin, most commonly mild rash and itching with immune therapy. And so during many of these cancer therapies for melanoma, you should maintain moisturization during treatment, and then you should talk to your care team about the possible need for an over-the-counter strength topical hydrocortisone cream if needed for new rash or itching, or sometimes an over-the-counter allergy medicine called an antihistamine for more diffuse itching, all of which you should certainly discuss with your care team at the first sign of any symptoms in your skin. Other things to be aware of in your skin are that the BRAF targeted therapies can cause sun sensitivity, and so, you know, patients should be performing adequate sun protection while on these therapies. And special tips I tell people are to not forget to protect your head and with a hat covering your ears as well, and to reapply sunblock to your hands after washing your hands if you're on one of these drugs that can make you sensitive to sunburn. And then other types of skin side effects that can happen during these BRAF therapies include development of new skin lesions called KAs or something called squamous cell carcinomas that your care team may have you see a dermatologist if needed at times for these lesions. And then rarely, but there can be rare or unusual skin side effects, so it's just important to keep an eye on your skin and to call your doctor with new symptoms that come up or new lesions that you notice while you're on therapy. And then finally, you know, I want to spend the most of my time talking about a really important topic to all of us, which is our quality of life. And I think that there are a few topics, in my opinion, that your doctor and you should actually bring up at every visit regarding your quality of life. And the most important topics, you know, and I think there are many, but I like to think of it about categories of your pain control, your energy level, your appetite, and your general mood and spirits. So regarding pain, some of you may not have any pain related to your cancer, although some of you may have cancer-related pain, which can really affect your quality of life. And so it's important to know what pain medicines you've been taking and what dose and schedule. And if you keep either a written log or a mental note about how often you're using these pain medicines and whether or not it's working, and how long it's working, then your doctor can best make adjustments to make sure your pain is controlled as well as possible in order to protect your quality of life. And if you develop new pain, you should also bring that up, as your doctor can help or recommend imaging to better evaluate what's the cause of the pain in order to plan for an intervention such as radiation therapy at times, which can help treat pain as well. In addition to your pain control, your energy level is, I think, a very important part of your quality of life. And it's also important to address in your conversation with your doctor. So if your energy level is low or if it's falling, that's something, in my opinion, that you should call your doctor between visits about. It's not necessarily something you have to wait for your visit to talk about. And your doctor may be able to look for reversible causes, for example, some of your hormones like your cortisol or your thyroid hormone that can affect your energy level that can be reversible very quickly. And your doctor may be able to help with a plan for your energy in order to improve your quality of life and possibly also to improve your independence, which is really interconnected with your energy level, your functional ability, and that includes your mobility, all of which are really important to address as needed as part of your quality of life at your visits. Your appetite was the other things that I mentioned, and what you are able to eat may be a very important part of your quality of life, because I think it's a part of all of our quality of life, whether we have melanoma or cancer or not, and eating is a central part of our day and our enjoyment for many of us. If your appetite's decreased, you can bring this up with your doctor and their team, or at times even a nutritionist, all of whom may be able to help make suggestions to improve your appetite and help your quality of life in that way. And then your mood and spirits, I think, are also a very important part of your quality of life that may change during your treatment and care from beginning to end and at different times during your treatment course. And so I think it's important to talk to your doctor about your mood, and it can be very helpful while you're being treated for melanoma at the beginning and the early discovery about your cancer and in the information gathering phase of your treatment. There may be changes in your mood, such as depression or anxiety, and these feelings, I think, are very normal for many patients or any patient that would be in your position, and your doctor and your care team, I think, can help you, and your cancer center in general may be able to help with resources or connecting you with patient support that can, you know, make you understand that other patients have felt these same experiences and that you can gain from others and their support. And finally, I think a quality of life concern that is very specific to patients with advanced melanoma is the availability of support and information. And I think that I addressed some of that earlier with, you know, knowing how to reach your care team and the availability of that support within your care system is a huge part of your quality of life that you can take control of by asking how to get in touch with your care team. And then information. So I think that the way that information is a quality of life concern to patients is because, as you've heard on this call, there has been such a rapid advance in melanoma therapies, so that patients and families have this added challenge of weighing all these new treatment options, including clinical trial participation. And this weighing this information and processing it can, you know, actually affect your quality of life if you feel that you don't have the information that you need, or you feel that you need additional help in sorting out your options. And so I think you should always be comfortable asking your clinical care provider the question, what about clinical trials? That's a question that can lead to sometimes a second opinion or being seen by a center that specializes in clinical trials, both to ask those questions, but also just to get a general second opinion about your treatment options, because this is a way to just get more information for you and for your family before starting any treatment if you feel that more information may help improve your quality of life as you're beginning to learn about your melanoma and your treatment. And I, you know, most often I don't think that there's an urgency to start your treatment that day or the next day. Your doctor will tell you, honestly, if there is an urgency, but usually I tell patients that we can take our time to get information and we can make a plan to start treatment within 1 to 2 weeks. And that, I think, helps a lot with our quality of life because we have the opportunity to process information with our family, perhaps look for a second opinion, and to learn about clinical trial opportunities. I think ultimately, above all, you should ask yourself, what is my quality of life and what are my goals for myself and for my family? Because if you ask yourself these questions continuously during your care, then you can continue this conversation in the clinic and with your care team in the most productive manner. And I think that those are, you know, I think the important beginnings of the conversation of quality of life that should be continued at all times with yourself, your family, and your provider. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gangadhar. That was really amazing. And I have to say the focus, your excellent focus really on the quality of life issues and actually and really spelling them out in such detail for people to recognize all those components that we very often don't get to go into in such detail and how important they are and their access to their healthcare team. And so it, really a wonderful presentation. Excellent. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Kelly. Ms. Kelly is Older Adult Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial services and programs and the role of support groups. And I have to say, each of your presentations have built on the other. It's just amazing groups. So I now turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thanks, Dr. Messner. As Dr. Messner said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people who are diagnosed with metastatic melanoma and their loved ones. We've been talking today about managing your care, your quality of life, and I'd like to talk now about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. So a little about us, we are a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area and over the phone nationally. We have support groups, which we provide face-to-face in New York. We do them over the phone nationally and online, both nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We provide practical help. We can help you navigate the healthcare system. We also provide some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers. And as I said before, they're completely free of charge. An oncology social worker really is trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family, friends, really the support network. I know Dr. Pasta talked about this in terms of, you know, we're treating not just the patient, we're treating the entire support network. You know, we're also trained oncology social workers to help patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact in care. And I find that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis in all of those areas I just mentioned is an important part of the healing process. I actually consider it to be a part of treatment. As you know, and as we've been talking about today, certainly cancer affects the whole person, the entire family, friends, the support network. What I really would like for you to go home with today is that you don't have to do this on your own. Joining a support group, you can connect with others who are going through a similar situation or experiencing similar problems. Individual counseling really gives you a space that's yours to talk about any of the issues that are coming up. These connections help lessen the isolation that often comes with a cancer diagnosis and treatment. And again, feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. And as I said before, I do consider it to be a part of treatment. At this time, we are offering a few different services. So, of course, we offer the individual counseling. We also offer several support groups. We currently have an online support group for anyone who is diagnosed with melanoma. So I definitely recommend that group to you. We also have face-to-face groups, general patient groups, as well as a telephone support group that's general patient. In addition, in all of these modalities, we provide caregiver services. So we have those with the phone groups, face-to-face groups, also with the online groups, and, of course, the individual counseling. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, call us. You can call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673. You can also visit our website, www.cancercare.org. And I definitely recommend visiting our website. It's very comprehensive. There's a lot of information, not just on our support services, but actually on all our programs, as well as your diagnosis, treatment, and just ways of coping as you go through this. This has been an amazing program today. We've gotten a lot of information. Know that we're here to help you. If you have questions about things or even about our services, don't hesitate to contact us. And again, remember, you're not alone in this. Our services really are here to help you. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. That was really excellent and very nice to let people know about these resources and that are available to everyone. And now we have time for questions. I want to thank our speakers for making that possible. And so I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board for the Q&A section. And I'm going to actually ask Candace to explain how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, I will explain to you before the call ends exactly how to actually get your questions, any questions that aren't answered, and how to get further resources. So, Candace.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Mr. Emil S. Your line is now open.
Yes. What are the risks and concerns of contracting skin cancers and melanomas if you're already a cancer survivor with another type of cancer and you're very fair-skinned?
Well, that's an excellent question, Emil. Thank you so much. Dr. Tabi, do you want to address that question to begin with?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much for bringing up that interesting question. There are obviously some susceptibility factors that can make you at a higher risk of melanoma. We know that actually probably the one that gives you the highest risk is having a prior melanoma, and that does increase your risk by about 5 times of getting a new one. Having said that, the general population still has about a 1 in 50 in men and close to that in women, a lifetime risk of actually developing melanoma. So I think those are kind of the most important numbers that you should hear about. There are a very small percentage of patients that have familial melanoma, and those are usually associated, that's less than 10% of all patients with melanoma, those are usually associated with genetic mutations that can then also predispose patients to other cancers, such as pancreatic cancer. And so those are the only really connections that are relevant. I think the most important factor in developing melanoma remains exposure, and that's UV exposure. So much less, dictated by your own genes as much as by also the environment and UV exposure. So I think, while we cannot control where our genes come from and potentially where they go, I think we can definitely control our behavior and be much more cognizant of the impact of the sun and UV radiation and do as much as we can for prevention. And on that note, I would also say that, for instance, things like tanning beds are things that are completely in the realm of increasing the risk of our younger folks to developing melanoma. And in the United States, there has been a concerted effort to try to actually ban those for patients, for people that are underage.
Excellent. Thank you. And does any of the other speakers wish to add to this excellent answer? Anyone have anything further to say? Okay. Very well answered. Thank you so much. And we have another question coming from Jennifer. What should I do to be ready for my treatment? So Jennifer's starting treatment. That question, Dr. Luke, could you address that question?
Yeah, sure. I think I get asked this a lot of questions about nutrition and other things. And I would say that just broadly speaking, it helps to be as healthy as you can be going into your treatment, just like it helps to be healthy in general. And so I tell most of my patients, you try to be as fit as you can be. That doesn't mean you have to go run like a marathon or something, but, you want to be fit, like, physically. You want to eat well, and by that I mean, a healthy diet. I really don't go in for any of these sort of extreme diets you may see on the Internet or discussed anywhere. Really the same kind of healthy diet that we recommend for cardiovascular health, et cetera. A little bit of exercise helps the body a great deal. And then finally, it's really the mental part that was touched on earlier that I really think is the most important. We realize that with many of the treatments we have for melanoma now, the safety profiles are really quite outstanding. It doesn't mean that people don't get sick, but for the most part, people do very well. And so trying to control your potential anxiety about the treatment, because I find, especially with the immune therapies, when patients come for their first treatment, it's commonly quite anticlimactic. They get their treatment and they actually feel just fine, but they're emotionally exhausted from the experience. And, you know, to some degree that can't be helped, but I really think that getting that mental piece there as quickly as possible, maybe perhaps even one of the most important things that we can do.
Thank you. And Ms. Kelly, do you want to add anything to that in terms of just the involvement with support services?
Yeah, so I think Dr. Luke kind of hit the nail on the head there that it really can't be avoided in certain circumstances, just the anxiety and the emotional impact of going into this. I would recommend before you even get in there for your treatments and those types of things, really to have a care plan at home. And that means having your supports in place. You know, if you're concerned about how you're going to be feeling, whether it's physically, emotionally, you know, having those basic things, those day-to-day things like meals set up, rides set up, you know, if you have children, childcare, those types of things. So you can take some of that stress off of your plate. And then, of course, just reaching out for supports. Dr. Gangadhar talked about this, talking to your care team about your mood and how you're doing, seeing who they can connect you to, where you can get supports, how you can get help with that.
Thank you so much. And we have some online questions, which are going to try to take them. I know these are late-breaking questions. So the first question comes from Tim. And the question is really a percentage or how many metastatic melanoma patients really participate in clinical trials. And I wondered if Dr. Pastor, if you could address that question in terms of participation in trials in general.
Sure. It's a really great question about how many patients actually do participate in trials. And unfortunately, when we look at the large groups of patients being treated all around the country, at least in the United States and even all around the world, the vast majority of patients with melanoma are actually not treated in clinical trials. And this is a situation that really exists across all of cancer spectrum, in that many people will get treatment for their cancer and may not even hear about a clinical trial possibility or may not even have one available to them. And so I think that this is something as doctors we always have to be thinking about, and even as patients and families and caregivers that are working with the patient with cancer, we really need to also be proactive about to really ask and inquire if there's a clinical trial that can be possible in a particular situation. Unfortunately, I don't have a percentage off the top of my head for exactly how many patients with metastatic melanoma participate in clinical trials in general. However, I do know that that number is not as high as we would like, and if more patients did participate in more clinical trials and there were more trials to offer patients, we could move progress forward more, even more quickly than we're already trying to do.
And this is Dr. Luke. I would just sort of add on to that fortunately, in the United States, the overall participation by patients in clinical trial ranks around 3 to 5% of the total population of people with cancer. And when people talk about trying to make breakthroughs in cancer, that is clearly one rate-limiting step. We just don't have very robust. Now, in melanoma, because before a few years ago we didn't have very good treatment, many patients did, and we're actually very concerned in the doctors who are developing these new treatments that patients will stop participating. And so I'd like to, again, sort of just say that consideration is really of a trial, even if you don't end up doing it, I think really, really is a good thing to do.
And so we hope that one of the things that you'll take away from today's program, for lots of different takeaway points, is that really the encouragement to participate in clinical trials, or to at least explore them and find out what's available. And I have to say that we have a program on clinical trials on May 20th, a workshop like this. And so many of you may have already signed up for it, but if you haven't, just really to find, I think what has been said is importance of really at least exploring it, knowing what that option is. And for many of us who've been in the field a long time, the treatment of today has often been based, of course, on the clinical trials in the past. Or Dr. Gangadhar, do you want to comment on that as well? Is that pretty much what our experience is in the field at this point?
Right. Clinical trials and participation it's a teamwork between the patients and the clinicians, and I think it works well as a team when everyone's informed and knows what their options are.
Excellent. And we have two late-breaking ones. So I'm a stage 3B survivor, 9 years NED. Can I give blood or be an organ donor? I get conflicting answers from my doctors. So Dr. Tabi, could you address this in a general way? Of course, we recognize that we will encourage Jane to go back to her treating healthcare team, but if you could just give some general information about this, the question about the giving blood or being an organ donor.
And yeah, also, absolutely. I would first congratulate the individual because that's wonderful, and that's, you know, the cures that we hope to achieve in the high-risk setting for patients that have high risk of recurrence, but obviously also have about 30 to 40% chance of a cure, which is a 3B disease, and I would consider this to be cured disease. But in terms of the giving blood, I think you have to follow the guidelines of the particular institution, state, or country in which you are. Obviously, blood banks are, you know, equipped with the data that they have at their disposal and make those decisions, and I think you should really follow those guidelines. Having said that, I mean, I think, again, there is the chance of melanoma being, you know, back decreases dramatically after you pass the five-year mark. Unfortunately, as with any cancer, we always consider it to be a possibility. That's why we usually recommend, you know, patients continue to follow up at least with a dermatologist, potentially with a medical oncologist, even for years after, you know, at least once a year after they're past the five-year mark. Having said that, again, the guidelines for a solid tumor transplant and organ donation are also kind of very much a moving target depending on the, science of the day. And to my knowledge, you know, 5 years is the usual mark for having a previous cancer. But again, I would follow the guidelines that are in place for that. You know, we're going to be learning a little bit more as we, you know, get all of this data that you have heard. Most of these progress that we made is made in the metastatic disease setting, and there's a lot of work to bring those earlier into the disease, you know, the 3A and 3B and 3C disease setting, where we probably stand a better chance of curing our patients. And it's likely that once we're in that setting as well, having been treated with immunotherapy, the risks of recurrences are likely to become even lower.
Well, I actually want to thank all of our speakers. You have been an outstanding, really an outstanding group. And although you can't hear us all applauding you, you really have been an amazing group. And I also want to thank all of our participants who really asked such great questions and really in participating both online on the telephone as well. Now, I do want to remind everyone this is a one-hour workshop. And in planning this program, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind all of you how to get any other questions you may have, because there are some more questions in line to be asked, and I know that. So I want to just let you all know that in terms of any medically focused questions you may have, I would recommend that you go ahead and call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, that's 1-800-422-6237, and their information specialists often await our calls from our participants after one of our programs, so just to let you all know that. You also may wish to call the Melanoma Research Foundation at 1-800-673-1290 as another resource to call. Now, in addition, if you have any questions that are really having to do with the emotional or practical or financial or joining a support group or counseling kinds of issues that you may be confronting, just want for some support, I would suggest that you go ahead and call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673. Perhaps most importantly, and you've heard this, I think, from many of our speakers, it's important to have, of course, support during this time. It's also important to connect up with your treating healthcare team. They are very vital to your, to your treatment and also to your support network. So please do take advantage of all of these services. Work closely with your healthcare team. Use these other resources that we're providing for you. And I do so much appreciate your all participating on today's program. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all. And, I just want to remind you all that we have another workshop, a part three to this. And this is really interesting, the role of immuno-oncology in the treatment of melanoma, which we really talked a little bit about today, but this will be in more depth, and it's on April 1st. So many of you have signed up, but if you haven't, it's another program to look forward to. Again, thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.